Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what Americans are saying about unions as we await a Supreme Court decision. The justices are set to rule on a case that challenges the fees public sector unions charge to employees who are not members. The unions say those employees still benefit from the contracts that the union bargains. But the plaintiff, Mark Janis, who works for the state of Illinois, deeply disagrees with the union's approach. He wrote in an op-ed, "At a time when Illinois is drowning in red ink and doesn't have the money to deliver core services such as caring for the poor and disadvantaged, the union is wrangling taxpayers for higher wages and pension benefits." We'll talk about what's at stake, but also how divisive public opinion is on unions. New research from APMG on that. And this is an opportunity for you to be heard in the conversation. Should employees who don't want to be part of a union be required to pay fees anyway, since they benefit from union deals? Are unions more necessary, in your view, for public sector employees like teachers and state workers? I want to hear from you also on the role that unions play today. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. And on Twitter at CarrieMPR. John Shelton is with us. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, where he specializes in union history. And he's with us today from Green Bay. And John, welcome back to the show.
That's great to be back. Thanks, Carrie.
Kim Crockett is with us, Vice President and General Counsel at the Center for American Experiment. She's with me in the studio. And Kim, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
John, a little bit of history here. As I was reading into the background of this, the U.S. Supreme Court has considered the role of and rights of unions before, including in 1977 in this Abood case out of Detroit. Would you catch us up on what happened in 77 and why that applies to today?
Sure. So the Abood case in 1977 dealt with a very similar set of circumstances. But actually, before talking about what the case said, I think it's important to talk about this entire effort as part of a really long historical effort by anti-union forces on the right to weaken public sector unions.
I'm going to get to that. I'd really rather start, if you will, with that case, and then we'll get to the larger issue around this, okay?
That's fine, but that's a big part of it. So this was a case that was sought after by the National Right to Work Committee, and they sought litigants in Detroit, actually, who had what was called an agency fee arrangement. Sometimes this is called fair share now, where the union had negotiated a deal with the Detroit Board of Education, in which all of those teachers in Detroit who were not members of the union paid for the cost of representation. And so it took about 10 years to get through the Supreme Court, and the litigants argued that the agency fee case. The agency fees actually violated the First Amendment rights of teachers, that they were compelled to the 300 teachers or so who had become litigants in the case. They were compelled to engage in speech that they didn't agree with.
Okay.
The Supreme Court basically sided with the union. It was a unanimous decision, and the key consideration was labor peace. In fact, in a decision that was written by Potter Stewart, I believe, the argument was that labor peace in the public sector was no less important than labor peace in the private sector.
So,
go ahead.
I want to turn to Kim on this. So, Kim, in 77, when Mr. Abood argued his objections of being forced into the union or paying the fees was a First Amendment issue. Is Mark Janis essentially arguing the same thing?
Yes. Yeah, Louis Abood and his colleagues made that argument. Rebecca Friedrichs made the argument just 2 years ago in Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. She made a First Amendment argument, which was collective bargaining in the public sector is inherently political. It affects taxes, spending, size, and policies of government. So you cannot do what Justice Potter Stewart said would be difficult. It was a naive decision, I think. Justice Stewart said, well, it's going to be hard to separate out collective bargaining from the political. But as long as public employees have some sort of appeal process, we should be good. John's right. They rested it on the idea that labor peace, and there was this threat, And if you go back, and he's a historian, there was a lot of unrest in the teacher sector. Mm-hmm. I remember it really well. I was in middle school during the big Minneapolis teacher strike, and all of that. It was very exciting. It came from a family of teachers. So this was the resolution of the court in 1977, and I think they were very dismissive of and naive about how political these unions were going to become.
Okay.
And how it would be very hard to find any distinction between politics and collective bargaining. So that's where we are now in 2018 before the
court.
As they're
about to.
Yeah, and it could be decision. It could be Thursday, it could be Monday. It's really any day now, but by the end of the month we'll have this decision.
Let me take a call here from Adam in Minneapolis. Hi Adam, what's your view on this?
Hi. I my view is one, I think it's disingenuous to lump the political side in. Because as union members, we can already recover the portion of our dues that goes to non-collective bargaining activities. So if you don't agree with the political stance of your union, you don't have to pay the dues that go to those political activities.
Right.
The second part is there are plenty of non-union opportunities out there. But I think it's hypocritical to join an organization or take the benefits of that collectively bargained contract and then crab about the organization that gives that to you.
I think that's a misstatement of fact. The teachers union, for example, Education Minnesota, collects PAC money, $25, from teachers on the union card, along with a $5 charge for an educational foundation. And teachers have to go through this paperwork process to get that $30 back. Very few bother. It's just the most principled.
But there is an opportunity to do that.
But what he's saying is that that's the only political spending by the union, and that is not true. Public employees in Minnesota are charged about 85% of union dues. So if it's $1,000 a year and you're a teacher, you're paying about $850. And if you look through the Hudson statements, and we can explain what that is if you want, a lot of the activity that the unions are reporting as representational or chargeable activities are, in fact, so blatantly political, and you can't get that money back.
So, John, what Kim is saying is there is no bright line between the political pursuits of the unions and the rest of the work they do, and people have the opportunity to try to get the political piece back, but you're not really being, you are still being politically represented.
Well, I think one of the things that I would remind everyone of here is that the way U.S. labor law works, so public sector labor laws in most states, including Minnesota, is modeled on private sector labor law at the federal level. And unions have what's called a duty of fair representation. So they have to represent. So I just remind your listeners that every union who represents anyone in this country is democratically elected. There's always a democratic election. And when a union wins that election, they're obligated, whether they want to or not, to represent everybody who is in that bargaining unit. So for a school district, if a union is voted in as the representation agent, it has to represent everyone in collective bargaining. It has to represent non-members in the grievance process, which can sometimes get very expensive. So I would concede that drawing a bright line between what's political activity, overtly political activity, drawing a line between overtly political activity and what's not is actually pretty easy. but the kind of softer edges that Kim's talking about. I would concede that, but I think that actually is in the service of a bigger principle, which is ensuring that unions have the resources to represent all of their members and all of the non-members in a bargaining unit, which they're obligated to do.
Call here from Emmanuel in Minneapolis. Hi, Emmanuel. What's your take on this?
Hello, and thank you very much for having me on this. I more so just wanted to make mention about unions and like my experience with them. I'd never been a part of a union, and then the one time that I was, I was delighted. I was kind of feeling good, and it was like a nice feather in the cap for me to actually be a part of something like that. And then I'd say about 5 to 6 months later, I went to go and try to utilize some of my member dues that I'd been paying. And there's been some sort of clerical error where my paperwork wasn't right. And all I wanted to do was just go get, you know, my teeth cleaned, get some glasses, you know, normal stuff, you know.
So, and Emmanuel, if I may, to cut through the details of this, your experience with the union was positive or not?
Oh, it was far from positive. And I don't want to carry on because I also consider them a formidable opponent. And that's where my issue was that it seemed more economic to let me go than to all of a sudden figure out a way to give me back money that I wasn't getting because I apparently wasn't put into the system properly.
Okay. Thanks for the call and your experience. Kim, you wanted to add?
Well, I just, if I could, and Emmanuel, I'm sorry that that happened to you. I'm not sure you were in the public sector. I wanted to address Mr. Shelton's comments. Back in the day when the federal government and the unions were working out their, you know, the deal on how the National Labor Relations Act and other legislation would go, unions demanded what John was talking about. They demanded that they be the exclusive bargaining representative in any workplace. And you can argue pro or con for that, but they won that right. So when you talk about the duty of fair representation, it's because they wanted to represent everybody in the workplace, even if people didn't want to be represented by them. And secondly, these elections that are supposedly democratic, they aren't, and they don't happen very often. For example, you would be hard-pressed to find a teacher in Minnesota today and call in if you're one of them who's actually voted in one of these elections.
You mean to whether the union, whether they want to have the union or not.
Right. This is not a real democratic process. It happened back in the early 70s when our Public Employee Labor Relations Act passed, based on the NLRA. But we haven't had elections in Minnesota in, like, you know, 30, 40 years for the most part throughout the system. It isn't real.
Let me say this, Kim, that the NPR newsroom is organized and part of SAG-AFTRA. We did have a democratic process. It was a bit divisive within the newsroom, but the people that wanted the union prevailed in that. And so, having gone through that democratic process, I have a tendency to agree with people that say you get a chance to vote on this.
Are you sector?
Well, I'm sorry, but the bottom line is that you know, unions always have the opportunity to decertify if they, you know, if they're not or the members have the opportunity to decertify the union if they're not representing them. And the other thing I would just point out is that unions have elected leadership. So the elected leadership engages in bargaining on behalf of their members. They engage in, you know, grievance procedures. And so they can be voted out of office. In fact, unions are probably one of the most democratic institutions that exist in the United States. They're certainly way more democratic than corporations, which tend to be top down. But the other point I would make about this is that, you know, this case, and I'm sure you were going to get to this, Carrie, but this case is one of a long line of cases that are being supported by right-wing money.
You wanted to talk about the right-to-work movement here. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, millionaires and billionaires. I mean, the Janus case, to go back to the initial impetus for the case, it actually started with an executive order by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, who is a billionaire who has ties to other billionaires like Richard Uihlein, who is becoming involved highly politically in my state. And they've argued for these, end agency fees in the name of First Amendment rights of workers. But they're backed by billions of dollars from groups like the State Policy Network, which has, Kim could probably help me with this, which has like 65 think tanks in states across the country.
John,
they take money from the Koch brothers.
John, I don't want to leave the impression here that there's some shadowy conspiracy going on. I mean, this is political expression, right? And it is organized, not in the union sense, but in the political sense, to try to pursue an agenda.
Let me make the point, which is that most workers approve of unions. They approve of the especially in the public sector. What my bigger point about this is that what these groups have had to do is find very small numbers of workers who disapprove of this policy. And I'm not going to say that they're not there, because they are, but these cases simply wouldn't happen without that dramatic amount of right-wing money pushing for.
Okay. Let me add this, because we have some APMG polling here, which is an arm of Minnesota Public Radio, that found that 62% of Americans believe that the country is better with stronger unions. And so overall public opinion seems to be with what John is saying. Kim?
Well, fortunately, we don't let polls determine whether or not someone's First Amendment rights have been trampled on. And you cannot impugn the intent of people like Mark Janis and Rebecca Friedrichs and Mr. Abood, who have begged the court to recognize that by forcing them to fund their public union, they are violating their rights as Americans. You just can't get around it.
Well, they're pursuing their cases in the courts,
exactly.
And the court is deciding. I don't know if they're begging or
anything else. You plead before the court.
They're going to courts to try to get a decision.
Right. They're going to court. And what's happened over the last 40 years since the Abood decision is a recognition, I think. And it's not, I'm not going to talk about what Professor Shelton has alleged. If we had a dollar for every time someone said we were funded by the evil Koch brothers, we'd be really well off. And these are tiny, and these are really small think tanks when you compare them to
There is a right-to-work movement that is trying to pursue an agenda.
But when you compare the finances of that to the finances of public unionism, it pales in comparison. But that's not what we're here to talk about today.
We're talking about some of the politics of it and the details of the case. Let me do this and invite some listeners in. Kim Crockett is with us here from the Center for the American Experiment in the studio with me. And John Shelton is with us, an associate professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Okay, you hear how the conversation is developing here. I'd like to hear from you. Should employees who don't want to be part of a union be required to pay fees since they benefit from union deals? And by the way, that's the question for public sector employees that the court is going to decide.
Right. It's just public sector.
Unions more necessary, in your view, for public sector employees like teachers and state workers? So consider that. 800-242-2828, 651-227 6000, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Michael says the destruction of unions has been happening since Reagan. Look at the economy today. Full employment, wages are low as ever, even considering inflation. Unions are a good thing. List all the good things like weekends off, 40-hour work week, and child labor laws. To the phones here to Nancy in Montgomery. Hey, Nancy, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Good morning. As a retired teacher, I was teaching for 30 years and was in the union for my entire career. I benefited in many, many ways from union membership. And I've always thought about the argument that people who don't want to pay the fair share amount shouldn't have to pay it. And in listening to your guest today, I'm thinking, why not let them simply opt out of the union entirely? Mm-hmm. And then there's no question about paying fair share. But that also means that they don't benefit from the union.
Right.
They need to negotiate their own contracts, their own health benefits, their own retirement, their own salary. They represent themselves somehow if they ever get into trouble. if they're not willing to fund the benefits of the union, if the balance for them does not come out in favor of benefiting the union, then they should not benefit at all.
John, what do you think of that argument? John?
Yeah, what a great point, Nancy. I mean, I totally understand the temptation to say, well, just let those people who don't want to join the union to be on their own. But, you know, one of the amicus briefs that was written, which was written by, I think, 30-something, you know, prominent economists, basically talked about this larger notion of what's called the free rider problem, which is basically what we're talking about, right? That if you don't have agency fees, a certain percentage of people, not because they oppose the union, but for any number of reasons, maybe they're facing financial hardships, you know, they don't contribute to something that they benefit from. And so I think it's a real concern. And if you think about this as a public policy, you know, there was just a report that came out from the EPI very recently that compared Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Wisconsin, we've done more than lost agency fees in the public sector. There's a whole host of laws that have really hurt unions in our state. But one of the things that they found is since Scott Walker came into office in 2010 and 2011 and passed Act 10, is that growth is much higher in Minnesota some portion of this is because of public policy like stronger unions. Growth is higher, jobs have grown more dramatically, and of course these are states that are very similar. So I think it's really in the public interest to ensure that unions are protecting middle-class jobs.
Kim, to that argument.
Well, I just want to thank Nancy for her very collegial attitude toward other teachers, and I think she's right. I mean, and that will be the outcome, by the way, should Mark Janus prevail. Her colleagues would have the right to opt out of the union. And the impact of that is the unions will want to retain their members. They don't want to have a loss in revenue. And so they're going to get really customer focused. I mean, this is the positive side of it that people don't hear.
You think it will improve the unions?
I really do.
But it
already has, because they don't want to lose those revenues.
But I don't want to be confusing here, Kim, just for a moment, because
right.
you were saying that the option, if the court decides with Janus, Nancy described a world where then as union, as a member of that workforce, you don't get all the other benefits and you negotiate your own individual contracts. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that that's a perfectly acceptable outcome.
Is that what you're suggesting
right.
will happen
right.
if
and
the court goes with Janus?
Yeah, and the school districts and other public employers will sort that out over time. And if and one of the benefits of it is I think you'll see public sector unions get very focused on actually representing members. They're off, you know, they're a complete extension in Minnesota of the DFL. They were more interested in for example, getting Hillary Clinton elected in 2016 than they were in finding out what teachers and other public sector employees needed and what was going on in their workplace.
Let's say that they worked on behalf of a presidential candidate. The rest of that is obviously your opinion on this. I'm going to grab a call that I think speaks to what Nancy was suggesting mm-hmm. to Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm currently a retiree, and I worked many years as a professional for corporate American company, big corporations.
Uh-huh.
And I also was a small business owner once. And then my last 16 years, I decided to become a teacher working for urban district in Minneapolis.
Okay.
And when I was working for corporate world, I was against union because I got a grievance from moving my desk once. And so I was angry about that. And so I was against union. But then when I was a public school teacher, I felt like I do need the union because I want to be 100% concentrate on my student, to work for my student, and I did not want to have anything to deal with politics, and I happen to be in an urban district that provide much better benefits.
So, Joe, you've seen this from both sides. Is that what you're telling us? Right.
Yes. And I wish employer and laborers can always work together.
Okay.
But unfortunately, nothing is perfect.
Okay.
No, nothing is.
Thank you. John, I wanted to ask you something that Kim brought up here. And I read this as in an argument by Dave Jamieson, the labor reporter for the Huffington Post, who wrote about, if workers can stop paying fair share fees, unions will have no choice but to prove their value to these workers. Inattentive and undemocratic unions could no longer afford to coast. Now, the Huffington Post is a pretty liberal publication. Kim was suggesting this. Do you think that's what will happen? More customer focused?
Well, let me first say, look, unions are not perfect, right? I mean, no institution in the United States is perfect. And there are certainly unions across this country who haven't been as responsive to their members as they could be. But the argument that the way to solve that is to throw out agency fees, I think, is deeply problematic. And I think the notion that unions are going to somehow get better with fewer resources is completely disingenuous. If you look at the I read several times the transcripts and the oral arguments in the case. The litigants in favor of eliminating agency fees and the supporters both admitted that this was going to harm unions in the long term, in the short term. Right now, I will agree with Kim is that if this happens, I think it is quite possible that some unions will become more responsive to their members. They will have to work harder. So, I'll agree with that. But I think long term, for most unions across the country in the public sector, and let's keep in mind that this is 23 states that we're talking about where these laws would be invalidated. I think it's going to make it much harder for them to represent the interests of their members, particularly in the short term. And that's going to have longstanding consequences, particularly when we're already seeing a dramatic decrease in the standard of living for the middle class in this country.
Kim?
I think they're going to have a really hard time spending as much money and effort on politics, national and state politics, as they do. But I think they'll have plenty of money to do representational activities and to really find out, what is it that you need? We have an attrition rate among our teachers that is extraordinary. Half of them have left by the age of 42. We have violence in our schools. We have a great deal of dissatisfaction.
None of that is the fault of the unions that represent them.
Well, but they're backing things like restorative justice policies. We could do a whole show on that, and I'd love to come back and talk about it. The teachers that we've done several focus groups with several dozen teachers, and they've told us they're having the worst, year of their career.
And do they blame the union for that?
Well, some of them do. Some of them feel so at risk that the thought of, working without one is terrifying. We have a lot of things going on in our public sector, especially schools, where I think if the unions could get very focused on solving those problems, you would find that teachers would be more than happy to pay, for example, for local representation, where they really do, where there really is a democratic process. But I think they're less interested. They don't even know what their state and national unions do when you ask them.
Kelly,
they can't even name them.
Kelly called from Otsego to say, I'm a teacher. How is corporate influence any different from union influence? Unions have an agenda, too. A call here from PK in Minneapolis. Hi. What do you want to add to this?
Yeah, hi. So just to the point about if you let individual teachers negotiate individual contracts, what can happen is that that just starts eroding the overall power of those new teachers who come in. We see that in universities. We have adjunct teachers earning at university level, not getting one-year contracts, not getting benefits, getting paid the equivalent of $100 a week to do their work. And that's why some of the university professors want to unionize, because it's a drain. Every time they hire new teachers now, they could, be presented with this option not to be in a union, and it'll cost them a little bit less. And so then you just end up eroding the power to negotiate for benefits and better wages. And we can see we're drowning in that right now with low-wage jobs.
I'm a little tight on time, so I appreciate you making that kind of brief. Here's John on Twitter who says, I'm a member of MSCF Union Higher Ed. Many of our faculty only have their jobs due to our contract that specifies 70% of the work is done by full-time faculty. Nationwide, it's about 30%. They benefit from day one. John, it almost sounds like you and Kim are in agreement that the court will come back and find for Janice. Do I hear that right in what you've been saying today?
You know, what's interesting about this is I'm not positive that the court will. I think if I were betting, I would say yes, probably that, you know, given that they've effectively been able to swing the balance toward the conservatives. I do think it's possible, it's likely that they're going to come down against agency fees. But one thing should really give them pause. You know, there's a labor journalist named Sean Richmond who's been making this argument, which is that if you make this, if this court case rules on free speech grounds, right, that teachers can't be compelled to pay dues, and you're essentially broadening what counts as free speech for public employees, there's a really compelling argument that limitations on unions elsewhere, other kinds of limitations, could actually fall under free speech. For example, in Wisconsin, public employees have lost the ability to bargain over really effectively over salaries and other kinds of working conditions and health benefits. There's a really compelling case that these laws in Wisconsin could actually violate workers' rights to free speech through their union. And so I think that what I'd really like to see are groups who are part of the state policy network, you know, like 10 of them at least wrote amicus briefs for this. I would like to see them support that challenge if that happens when the Supreme Court, when and if the Supreme Court passes what we think they will in Janus. But Kim, I actually think there's a good chance that the court might consider that and be a little worried about that.
Kim, are you anticipating that the court will find for Janus?
You know, I don't make a practice of saying what I think the United States Supreme Court is going to do. What I would say, since we're short on time, is that we've been digging into the statistics over in Wisconsin, because not only do they have right to work, but the state no longer collects union fees. As John said, collective bargaining over there has been limited. And what we're finding, we're looking at teacher data in particular, is that not only are they maintaining the salaries that they had before, but they continue to increase even in districts where the union has fallen away because so few teachers belong. There's just been a natural decertification process. So I want to assure teachers listening out there that the bottom doesn't collapse. We've talked to a superintendent in Milwaukee who has to pay teachers more than he did before, because if they have special skills, especially like STEM, because their skills are in such demand and there's actually a marketplace being created and teachers are making more money, not less.
Kim, I'm sorry we're out of time. John, I wish we could go on. Thanks to both of you for good conversation, and to everybody who called in on this. As Kim noted, I think the decision coming either Thursday or Monday from the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll report on it when it does.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.